inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come tumbling.
Welcome to The Manic Gardener, where every week we spend some time on some aspect of organic and sustainable gardening or some environmental or political issue that's related to them. Today, it is the root of all organic gardening, composting. I'm Kate Gardner. Be sure to check out the parallel post on the blog, themanicgardener.com. Everybody knows, to some extent, about composting, but an awful lot of people are still very uncertain about how to do it. And in particular, rumors sort of waft through the organic gardening world about hot compost, about cold compost, about, oh, the horrors of going anaerobic. What do these things mean? And in the latter case, at least, how does one avoid them? To answer all of this, I've turned to Graham Goldbuff, who is the Resource Conservation Program Manager with Seattle TILF. And as such, he actually does quite a number of things, only one of which is the composting program there. But he does do that. And we're going to try to go through the composting process for beginners and perhaps advanced beginners. We'll see how advanced we get here. Welcome, Graham.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
I'm good. And yourself?
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. So, composting. Why bother to begin with? Let's just spend a minute or two on, you know, what the benefits are, and then let's get into the how-tos of it.
Sure. Well, really, we recommend it so you gardeners can have more work to do in the garden. We know
that's what you guys
are going at.
Thank you.
We look at it from sort of three angles. It's good for your garbage bill. It's good for the environment, and it's good for your garden. For your garbage bill, you know, the less stuff you're putting in there, the less amount of stuff is being hauled away each week, and that can theoretically reduce your bill size. You might live in a city that, you know, allows you to reduce your garbage can size if you're putting in less material. That's good. The environment's a big one as well. As organic materials break down in a landfill, they can generate methane, which is, I believe it's 21 times more potent than carbon dioxide of a greenhouse gas.
I think that's right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then for your gardens, a huge one as well. It's incorporating compost is the best form of recycling, and it's the best way to add organic matter back to your soil, and that helps with drainage, water retention, to slow nutrient release. It helps your soil hold on to nutrients. It inoculates it with soil biology and provides your soil organisms with habitat. And those have a multitude of positive effects on the plants in your garden. So, best way to get that organic material in your organic garden.
So I'm feeding the soil organisms when I put down compost.
Yeah, you're feeding them and giving them homes. And you're also, when you're putting in that compost, you're bringing a ton of organisms in there already that are left over from the composting process. So it's just a great kickstarter of the soil biology.
Yeah. And don't those organisms actually help break down minerals into forms that are available to plants?
Yeah, that's one of the, plenty of those organisms do that, and actually plenty of organisms do that in a compost pile as well. They actually mineralize certain nutrients and make them available to plants. That's why compost is, I don't want to encourage people to think of it as a fertilizer per se or
yeah,
in the classic sense, but it does provide some lower levels of fertility,
mm-hmm,
undoubtedly.
Okay. All right, and mineralization here means what exactly?
Oh, sure,
it drops up all the time.
Yeah. So mineralization basically means it primarily refers to nitrogen, but a lot of other compounds as well. The predominant source of nitrogen is from the atmosphere, so it's in a gaseous form. And mineralization is when organisms pull. They use a lot of ingredients in their processes, if you will, besides organic matter. They use oxygen and water, and they get their oxygen from air in the atmosphere, which is mostly nitrogen, and so they're converting that nitrogen gas into forms that plants can take up.
All right,
then. Does that make sense?
And so the microbes can get their nitrogen from the air,
mm-hmm.
but most plants cannot.
Yeah, no, they can't. It has to be converted into a mineral form.
Right.
Something
okay.
that's very similar to what's in your fertilizer.
Yeah. Okay, and that's one of the main reasons we want all those microbes in the soil. I kept, you know, when I was a beginning organic gardener, I kept seeing all this stuff about good microbes, and I was, for the longest time, I couldn't decide whether this was some kind of cult or whether there was actually some science behind it.
Oh, I think plenty of people would argue it is some kind of cult, but there's plenty of science behind it as well.
Yeah.
It's becoming more and more, the importance of soil biology is becoming more and more understood with each year.
Yes.
And it can't be overstated.
Yes, I've become convinced of that as well. I was very cautious in endorsing it, but actually one of the things that astonished me when I worked on a big composting article was how many of the claims about compost turn out to be true.
Yeah, it's a lot of people will say it can be a silver bullet for a number of reasons, and that's an analogy I like to use, at least.
Yeah, it improves the soil, it feeds the plants, as you say, at least a little bit. It just has multiple benefits. Well, let's come back to that later and talk a little bit about how one does this. I'm a beginner. I want to start a compost pile. How would you recommend that I begin?
Sure, no problem. The first thing I would encourage you to do is don't get too overwhelmed and take a look at a couple of the processes that I'll describe and figure out what makes the most sense for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, composting can be, it's definitely, you know, another thing to do in the garden, and we all have plenty to do, and there's you know, whatever process works for you is something we want to encourage. The recycling of organic material is a good thing, whether you do it in a hot compost process like you mentioned, or if you're doing it in sort of a more cold, passive form.
Are you saying that there isn't just one right way?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I'm not going to be hurled into the outer circle of the universe if I do.
No. There's we want to frame this as something that people can do and be successful with, and yeah, there's a lot of ways to do it. And that's true in the commercial market. That's true definitely in the backyard as well with home gardeners and home composters.
Well, could you explain for starters the difference between this hot and cold composting business?
Sure. So hot composting is essentially getting your pile up to temperatures of greater than 130 degrees. And I'll explain how that all works,
mm-hmm.
Which is that's effective in reducing the likelihood of having three things in your pile: weed seeds, pesticide residues, and any sort of pathogens to human health that might come in through manures or spoiled food or something like that. If you're getting your pile up to those temperatures, you can have with a pretty decent level of confidence that you're not going to have pervasive issues with those guys as well. Now, of course, there's exceptions to that, but it's a good rule of thumb. Passive
composting. So basically, if I can get my compost pile above 130 degrees, that temperature will kill pretty surely most pathogens, and it will reduce pesticides, break them down, and kill weed seeds.
Yeah, it's
okay.
There's exception, but that's a good rule of thumb. If you're getting it up to those kind of temperatures, you can not a lot to live in past that, except some certain microbes.
Right. So the cold composting.
Yeah, that's sort of the opposite. That's not getting it up to those temperatures, just piling material up and letting it break down over time. You know, if you think of a forest, eventually everything breaks down. It's, you know, what you think of as the duff layer or leaf litter. That's how nature composts in a more slow, less managed way. And that can also be thought of as cold composting, and that's a way that gets plenty of merit as well, or that has plenty of merit.
So if I'm cold composting, I might need to be more careful about what I put into the pile, but, within certain limitations, it should just compost away quite nicely.
Absolutely, yeah. You're not going to have that level of control for some of those undesirables that I mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And you're also going to need some more time on your hands. But
Just to let the composting happen.
Exactly, to get a finished product. But, mm-hmm. You know, if you've got the time and you want to do that kind of management and you know what you're putting in, cold composting is a great practice.
Well, say I want to begin there because I you know, I've heard about all this turning that has to be done at the right time with the hot ones. And I feel a little overwhelmed here. So I'm going to start with something I could just leave.
Sure. And truthfully, there's to cold compost, there's not a ton to it beyond that, you know. Find yourself a space. You can have a bin to do this. You can just have a exposed bit of ground. You can do it even on a concrete pad if you want, but it's just piling material up and walking away. And depending on the kind of things you're putting in, over time that stuff is going to break down and turn into something that is loose, crumbly, dark, looks and smells, and has similar texture to soil as well. And that's cold composting in a nutshell. There's really not much more than that. Now, this can take some time. We're talking at least a year for that material to turn over, sometimes a lot longer, but that's all there is to it.
Well, it's got to be a catch somewhere. What can go wrong with this system? It can't be that easy.
Sure. So, you know, what could go wrong is if you're getting, you know, the dandelion heads in there or... Himalayan blackberry is a real classic invasive in the region I live in.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting those parts of the plants in there. And
dandelion heads are a problem because those seeds are going to survive that composting.
Exactly,
process.
Yeah. They're not going to be cooked off by those hot temperatures. So that's the kind of management you're going to have to do. You got to be real careful about what you're putting in there. But, any of your classic garden waste is totally fine. Grass clippings, deciduous leaves, straw or hay that you're bringing in is fine. You name it, really. Perennial and annual trimmings, that stuff is all good for a cold compost pile. And, you throw that stuff together. You can mix it up if you want. You don't even have to necessarily. If you're cold composting, you don't need to add moisture to it or anything like that. It's just letting that stuff break down over time as it would if it was, falling off the plant in a natural cycle, or if it were in the forest or something of that sort.
Well, I had a friend who actually stopped composting because her neighbors complained, and this is the system she was using, her neighbors complained mm-hmm. about the smell.
Yeah. Cold composting can definitely, if it's, we're presuming it's something you're not managing about, or you're not managing, and if you're adding a lot of particularly nitrogen-rich material, and you're not doing anything to manage it, the smell can sort of come up, and you're getting a lot of nitrogen in your green plant material. So that would be things like grass trimmings or rose leaves that you've clipped off or that sort of thing. So if you're really overloading your cold pile with that kind of stuff, you can certainly get some smell, but that's true in a hot process too.
You're talking about it smelling like ammonia or something?
Yeah, ammonia. Sort of rotten eggs is the more user-friendly smell that people describe it smelling like. But that's what happens. That there's basically not enough oxygen available for those materials to compost in an aerobic process, or which is a good-smelling process. And so they start producing ammonia gas, and that's the smell people are smelling there.
The rotting smell is the ammonia smell.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yep.
Okay.
Rotten eggs. That's kind of the classic descriptor.
Now, and that happens when there's a lot of activity going on, like the nitrogen-rich materials, but not enough oxygen to keep the process aerobic. And so this is what is described in those, terms of horror as going anaerobic.
So it's, it's not a horror process. It's reversible. So what's happening there is your pile's either getting too overloaded with nitrogen material, or there's not enough air space in the pile for oxygen to penetrate and do its, and you know get to the levels of concentration that a compost pile needs to be happy, which is about 5 or 10%. And that
so
can
you
happen,
said it's reversible.
Yeah.
What
you want to know how to do that?
Yeah.
Sure. So yeah, it's that would be a byproduct of your pile being one of two things, either too wet or too much nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So what you're going to want to do is pull the pile out, throw it on a tarp on a nice sunny day, and let it dry out over time. That's I'd say at least an afternoon is going to make a dent in the pile. But if you got more time to let it sort of air out and for evaporation to take place in the pile, that's a good thing. Or adding in some more carbon-rich materials. So wood shavings or shredded newspaper or fall leaves, anything that's sort of brown in color is a good quick indicator of being carbon-rich, and working that stuff in to balance out the nitrogen is going to help cut down on that smell.
So I would find something that would balance out the nitrogen by adding more carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about when I put it back together, taking a few larger sticks and throwing those, or small branches to create air pockets, does that work, or does the stuff just collapse around them?
Instead of throwing in whole sticks, what I would recommend is trying to chop or chip that up a little bit. That will, you know, you're increasing the surface area of the material when you're doing that and creating more of it in some way. You're exposing the inside of the material as opposed to just the outside. So that's kind of more material to break up the pile and create more air pockets, if you will, whereas if you just put the stick in, you're just going to get an air pocket around the stick of it effectively. Does that kind of make sense?
Yep, and you're also exposing more area to, I don't know how to say this.
For the microbes to colonize.
Exactly. So there's more carbon available mm-hmm. if it's chopped up than if it's in one piece.
Yep, that's true as well.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's going to help.
Okay. So let's go on to the hot system. Mm-hmm. And then we may want to come back to this one and talk a little bit more about problems that can arise or not. But
sure.
Okay, so I've decided to move on to what the big league.
Yeah. It's a similar process, but there's a few more things you want to pay attention to. You're going to definitely want to pay attention to your mix, essentially, of your carbon and nitrogen-rich material. What you're really going for is a 30-to-1 carbon-to-nitrogen ratio. Is that one of the composting buzzwords or terms you've heard thrown around?
Oh, yeah.
I'll explain that. It basically means how many carbon atoms are in a, you know, piece of material versus how many nitrogen atoms. And organic materials, which is the things we're talking about here, your garden waste, it always predominantly has more carbon. So what you're trying to do is get a mix of about 30 carbons to 1 nitrogen overall. That's the ideal ratio of that's the ideal carbon to nitrogen ratio. The question
and this
then
is
becomes
roughly corresponds to your browns and your greens.
Yes, yeah, your browns and your greens. Your mm-hmm. your greens are your nitrogen and your browns are your carbon. And the question then becomes, well, how do I know if I have 30 carbons to 1 nitrogen and can see the atoms? So you're going to have to take my word at this, and there's always a little bit of variation, but the quick and dirty answer is roughly a 50-50 mix of browns and greens, or carbon-rich stuff and nitrogen-rich stuff, will get you about that 30-to-1 ratio.
Now, why would a 50-50 mix get me 30-to-1?
No problem. That's a great question. I sort of touched on it a little bit earlier. It's inherently, with any kind of organic material, you have a lot more carbon than you do nitrogen, no matter what it is, no matter if it's a woody stick or if it's a, you know, really tender green blade of grass. There's always more carbon in it than there is more nitrogen, but the ratio is what you're trying to balance, essentially. Does that make sense?
Yes. So if I use, in fact, half and half, I will end up with, not with, 50% carbon and 50% nitrogen, because even the things that are rich in nitrogen, in fact, have more carbon in them than they do nitrogen.
Exactly. So inherently, you can kind of think about it this way too. Your nitrogen's most often you're, unless you're just composting, you know, straight grass or straight manure, which can be done as well, nitrogen's usually your kind of limiting factor. Mm-hmm. So you always need to add that stuff, you know, at a somewhat increased rate. So that's why it's a 50-50 compared to 30-1. But on a molecular or atomic level, it really is more like 30-1.
Yeah.
If you're looking at that.
Now, I have to ask about this from a mm-hmm. couple of different perspectives. First of all, most of the how-to articles I've looked at, which talk often about layering for a hot pile, seem to say something closer to truth two-thirds browns, one-third green than this 50-50 mix.
Yeah, I to be honest, that is not something I've come across in my own reading and my own practice. But,
okay.
You know, the 50-50 is what we teach, and the 30-1 is really what you're going for. And mm-hmm. any of those resources you're consulting often have, you know, long list of carbon to nitrogen ratios of common, you know, garden debris items.
Yes.
So, you know, you can say, oh, I've got, you know, grass and... you know, grass and leaves on hand today. And I know I have them in about equal volumes, and I take a look at what their ratios are. And so I kind of figure out, you know, I do a little math and figure out what the middle ground is there if I blend them at equal volumes. So you can get to, you know, you can kind of design your mix and design your pile. That's more work than most backyard gardeners usually do.
Yeah.
So that's why we like using that 50-50, you know, quick fix. It's something you can ground check with your eye really easily.
Yeah.
Instead of having to do a lot of math and looking things up.
And I suspect that you're pretty much guaranteed to get a hot pile with that mix.
Yeah, yeah, you can get really close. We made piles last week just using a quick 50-50 eye check, and we were pulling 140-degree temperatures this weekend. So you can definitely get up to temperature real quick with a 50-50 mix.
And you're talking within a few days.
Yeah, yeah, within
yep.
about 3 or 4 days.
Yep. Yeah, isn't that neat?
Yeah, it never gets old, you know, no matter how many times you do it.
I know. Occasionally I've had one zoom up overnight, and, you know, by day two, it's within striking range. It's like, yes!
Yeah. No, the minute those piles are built, the microbes are ready to get working. There's one more point to a few more points to the hot pile
yes.
that I haven't covered yet, and want to make sure our listeners know about that. But you're adding... typically for a cold pile, you're not adding moisture, and moisture is something you're just kind of relying on the ambient moisture that's in the materials you're composting. For a hot pile, moisture is typically something you do add.
Yep.
And composting takes place best, or it gets the hottest temperatures with like about a 40 to 60% moisture content, and that's by weight. Now, again, how do you figure that out?
Indeed.
There's some real good simple field tests that you can do for that. You stick your hand in the pile, grab a handful of your mix, give it a squeeze, and we like to say if it has a consistency of a wrung out sponge, that's a good indicator of that 40 to 60% mix.
So it feels damp, but it's not wringing wet.
Yeah, and if you give it a really good squeeze, like, you know, harder than you've ever squeezed anything before, like you're really trying to hurt it or something, you know, maybe you get 2 drops of water to come out of there, and that, you know, might come out through between the cracks of your fingers or up, you know, by your knuckle or thumb or something. You're not going to get, you know, a stream of water or anything like that.
Right.
That's, if you're getting that and it sort of feels like a wrung out sponge, you're feeling some moisture but not super saturation, that's within that 40 to 60% range, and you're in good shape then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anything else you wanted to add about the process?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You're going to want to make sure that the pile is able to be oxygenated. So a really good way to do that is making sure you have inputs or debris or whatever you want to call it of all different shapes and sizes. If you're putting in, you know, just grass, that stuff can compact really easily, or just leaves, it's all kind of the same and it all can sort of mat up, and that eliminates pore space for oxygen to get in. So really getting a nice mix of materials, getting things of all different shapes and sizes, that's going to allow for oxygen to come in.
Okay.
So
I've got to stockpile this stuff ahead of time, in other words?
You can, or you can, you know, just clear out the yard one day and make a pile at the end. It's plenty of people do stockpile materials. Composters quickly come up with, like, ooh, this is my favorite stuff to compost, and they will start stockpiling it. But it's not to say you have to do that either.
But I have to have a certain volume of stuff to get a hot pile.
Yeah, that's true as well. So some stockpiling can go a long way. We, compost piles can get up to temperature at a handful of volumes, but really kind of that sweet spot is about a cubic yard. So a volume that's about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet in terms of length, width, and height. So that will allow the pile to hold on to the heat that it generates, and also to not become too overwhelming that it really gets up to temperatures that can be a little bit scary or dangerous. That's overheating is a problem you can see with big compost piles, but if you keep it in that cubic yard range, you'll be fine. That's a nice sweet spot.
Yeah, because if it goes over 160, it can start killing off the beneficial microbes, right?
Yeah, I mean, at real high temperatures, 160, 170, you start to see some kill off. I mean, piles can even catch on fire, to be completely honest, if they get way too hot. But if you're keeping it within that cubic yard volume, you're not going to have to worry about that. It's going to be in a good 130 to 150 range, and you'll have plenty of microbes all over the material.
I had no idea.
Oh yeah, it can happen.
I gather it has happened.
Oh yeah, it does happen. Not, like I said, not as much in the backyard, but it certainly has happened. I've seen backyard piles used to power hot tubs, where people have run tubing through them and use it to heat water. I've seen people cook fish in compost piles, so they can get up to serious temperatures, no doubt.
This is better and better.
See how it's kind of a cult?
Oh, see, I told you it felt like a cult, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
If you're on the outside of the cult, it's very odd.
Yeah, well, it certainly is odd, but, you know, part of it is, I guess we encourage that experimentation and trying and, learning from successes you've had and piles that, you know, maybe didn't get too hot or cold piles that went really quickly. You know, it's there's no better way to learn composting than just and trying it and doing it and diving in and seeing what you come up with, and not being be concerned with the results, but don't be overly concerned, I guess. That's my overarching advice.
Right. Well, let's talk for a minute about how you keep a hot pile hot, and then about a little bit more about materials, what you put in, what you don't. So I get my pile built. I've got a cubic yard. It gets hot. I'm thrilled. And then it starts cooling down.
Yeah, so compost piles kind of go through a temperature arc that looks like a hill. After about, a day to 3 days, maybe 4 days, it's going to hit a peak temperature, and then it's going to start cooling down. And that heat's generated by microbes eating up all that organic matter, all that organic material, all that stuff with carbon and nitrogen. And there, as they eat, they generate heat. And that's what you're seeing when you're seeing a compost pile temperature. So as it starts to cool down, you're going to say, I want it to stay hot. I want to kill those weed seeds. I want to, and the heat kind of makes the process go a little bit faster. And, you know, maybe you're really rearing to get your compost out in your garden, which most folks are. So you want to know how to keep it hot at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And really the key to doing that, there's a few steps you can take, but step number one is to turn the pile. And what you're doing there is reintroducing oxygen to those microbes. As that, as your organic material has broken down, you've had volume reduction. The particle sizes of the organic material that you're putting in has, you know, it's gotten smaller and smaller, and that stuff compacts and fills in airspace, you know, just like soil in a container or soil in a pot. And so turning it kind of fluffs it up and reworks space for oxygen to move in and for those guys to get going again.
Right. Okay, so the turning, anything else?
You can possibly add some nitrogen material if you want. So,
my kitchen garbage.
We were saying that, what's that?
My kitchen garbage. I don't think we've mentioned that yet.
Yeah, we haven't talked about food waste so much. You can certainly, you can certainly add food waste material to your compost pile. That stuff is very rich in nitrogen and other nutrients. It's something, being in an urban area, we tend to discourage it or encourage people to use caution, as that really makes your compost pile attractive to rats, raccoons, whatever other sort of pests that exist in urban areas. And it's not that those guys are bad necessarily. They just, they can carry diseases and pathogens with them, and we don't want to be encouraging that. But if you're in a more rural area, mixing that stuff in is totally fine, and it's a good, quick nitrogen kick.
I had never thought about kitchen waste being a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that it's a problem per se. It's just, it's something, at least in my teaching, it's something we encourage people to use caution with, just to discourage rodents and to, prevent one more method of pathogens, things like E. coli, salmonella, what have you, that rats and other critters carry on them, to keep that stuff away from your compost pile.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say there's not other methods of composting that material, but... go ahead.
Sorry. What about covering the pile so they can't get
covering.
In?
Yeah. There's all kinds of armoring you can do to your compost pile, and I encourage people to get creative with that. I think what covering does more really than rodent prevention is helping the pile hold on to the moisture that was added to it. Unless you're talking concrete walls and stuff, which are used in some levels, but not in the backyard so much. I think covering is really more of a moisture retention thing than a rodent prevention.
Because it won't keep rodents out?
Nothing I've seen really will. I mean, I like to say there's no such thing as rat-proof. So so it's better just to... What we encourage is people to use caution or not do it and use a separate, more enclosed armored system. Or
for the kitchen waste.
Yeah, for kitchen waste.
Mm-hmm.
But if in areas or programs where those options aren't available, mixing that stuff into your yard, or you might not have rat issues, mixing that stuff in is totally fine.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think we have rats where I am. I'm in Bozeman, Montana, for what that's worth, but okay, so in more urban areas where rodents really can be a problem, that's something to be aware of.
Yeah, it's that's the context in which I'm teaching predominantly, but that's not to say that this stuff can't break down.
Yeah,
and that it shouldn't be composted. That's definitely not what I'm trying to say.
Right. Okay, well let's talk for a second about actually building this hot pile. Because, for instance, I've got this wonderful mix of, and I've got 50% and so on. If I put it all in a pile and I start, spraying it with a sprinkler head on my hose, most of the water is going to run off.
Yeah, just run off the side. That's a great question. And you mentioned layering earlier as being a good way to get a hot pile. Mm-hmm. What I really recommend doing is taking that... the volume of stuff you've got on hand, that cubic yard, throwing a tarp out on the ground, dumping all the stuff on there, getting a pitchfork out, and really mixing it up, just like tossing a salad. And think of, as you break the sprinkler out or the foe's head, hose head.
Like foe's head. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
You break that up, think of that as the salad dressing, and really... getting that stuff mixed together. There are people who swear by layering. I haven't found it to be as successful of a method myself personally, but that mixing will work every time and be certain to get it all up to temperature.
Yeah, I prefer the mixing. I've done both, but the mixing can be a little bit more work. But even if I'm layering, I just make the layers really thin and I'll get a couple on there, and then I'll just kind of mix them up with the fork a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll work too. Same concept.
Yeah. And then I do some spraying, and then I do a couple more, and I mix them up a bit, and I spray a bit.
Yep.
But your method, the stick it all on the tarp and do the salad, the water as salad dressing at the time, would really ensure that it's well coated without being sopping wet.
Yeah, and getting that moisture right at the beginning, I think, is a key to composting. It's or key to hot composting, at least. It's and it's something that gets better over time with practice. But if you if you know you're getting that material with a good, and you're, you know, you're doing your squeeze test every so often to make sure it's feeling like a wrung out sponge and it's feeling like that evenly all over the pile, if you get that right at the beginning, you're going to both get up to temperature and you're not going to have to add moisture at any point in time, which is another thing that can be done at that turning phase or adding more nitrogen. But if you get it right at the beginning, you can coast right through the process.
Well, one of the other things that strikes me is that with my method, it's possible to overwater it. Mm-hmm. With yours, I presume that when you're done, you know, mixing this salad, you're then going to pick it up with the pitchfork and, you know, pitch it off into its bin or its pile. And as you do that, really excess moisture is going to fall off.
Yeah, exactly. That's totally true. And that's a nice benefit of that method as well.
Yeah.
It might feel a little bit more saturated before you pitch it over to wherever it is, but feel it at the end where it's, you know, where it's physically placed, where it's going to stay throughout the process, and it will feel a little bit more dry. That's totally true.
Mm-hmm. So what if I've gotten this all into one pile and I wait a couple of days and it's just not heating up very much, very fast. I know I've got my 50-50, you know, I just built it. So there ought to be enough oxygen, and it's not just a pile of, lawn trimmings, which would just turn into a slimy green mess. So what would you recommend I do?
Yeah, so if it's not heating up after a few days, that's usually an indicator of two things. Either that there's not enough moisture in the pile or that there's probably too much carbon in there. The 50-50 is a rule of thumb, but some stuff has a lot, you know, the 50-50 green to brown is a rule of thumb, but, you know, some brown stuff has a lot more carbon than other brown stuff. So that's why it's always good to, you know, consult those compost resources and figure out what the C-to-N ratios of your materials actually are. But some good quick fixes would be, you know, pull the pile out, add a little bit more moisture, you know, maybe getting it, get it to a point where you're doing the squeeze test of the material and you're getting two or three drops of water that come out of your mm-hmm. hand when you're squeezing it,
mm-hmm.
Or working in some more nitrogen-rich material. That's, same idea as you were asking earlier about how to heat it back up after it's already come to temperature. You know, same thing if it hasn't heated up yet. Work in some grass clippings, work in a little bit of food waste, work in some manure if you have that. Manure is kind of a misnomer because it's usually not green in color, but it actually is very nitrogen-rich, and we think of it as a green in the compost process.
Indeed.
But so working in some more of those materials should help offset some of that carbon that's there. And the carbon's the stuff that's the slowest to break down. It's what you're going to see in your pile at the end of the process. That
are still there.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's the kind of stuff you're going to recognize at the end. And it really, what that is it just takes longer for that stuff to break down than those compounds, the lignin, the cellulose, what have you, that's in wood. They're just more complex. They look more like a, you know, two hands that are joined together instead of just, like a simple water molecule or something like that. So they're physically harder to break down.
So would I be better off if I somehow arranged to not have any lignin or cellulose in my compost mix?
Oh, it's not that you'd be better off. It's just you're going to have some of that at the end. And that's not to say you can't, when you sift and screen out all the fine particle, nice, dark, good stuff, it's not to say you can't take that leftover wood and throw it back through the process. It's,
mm-hmm.
There's still plenty of organic material and carbon that wants to break down over time. And, you know, some people like a somewhat woodier compost, depending on the application you're going to use it for. So it's not bad, but it's... It kind of just is what it is. You know, if that's what you've got on hand and you want to compost it, go for it, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Aren't lignin and cellulose also the basis for humus?
Yeah, I mean, all carbon compounds are. So that's sort
Do
of...
I mean
those
humus?
Are sort of, yes.
I mean humus. Oh.
It is humus. One of those tricky words. That,
hmm.
That, yeah. Anyhow, what that is it's just It's organic matter that can't, or carbon compounds that can't be broken down anymore. It's totally stable. It's not going to decompose. It's not going to degrade or do any of that. And really any carbon compound, lignin, cellulose, to more simple things, sugars and starches, what else that are carbon-based? Cellulose, there's a couple I'm forgetting.
You're on your own, but, here.
What's that? Yeah.
I can't help you.
You know, all that stuff makes up humus, as do some nitrogen-based compounds. But that stuff takes the longest time to turn into humus, effectively.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people actually describe finished compost as humus. And mm-hmm. I've always objected to this because my understanding of humus is that it takes a lot longer to form than anything that we're doing in our backyards.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with your analysis. You know, humus isn't really I don't think of it as like a commercial product or something you can make necessarily. I think of it as a byproduct of biology. You know, humus is what people refer, you know, I'm going to keep going back to the forest floor analogy, but mm-hmm. that stuff, once it's past, you know, the duff or the leaf litter layer, and it's this really unrecognizable organic material, that's what, you know, that's what forest ecologists and soil scientists and what have you have called humus forever. And the truth is compost isn't terribly different from that stuff. It's just, but it's something we're managing for, whereas, you know, the forest is just doing it, because it's always done it that way. And it's, I mean, there are plenty of people probably argue it's the forest is managing for that stuff too, but compost is just making humus with human influence, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I feel as though it's an important distinction, but
yeah, no, I would agree. It's, you know, we have people call us and ask us where they can buy humus pretty often. We're like, well, no one's marketing anything as humus, but it's, you know, you can buy compost, which is really similar. It's going to get you the same kind of benefits. I think that's sort of where people get tripped up.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I said, a lot of sites actually will define compost as humus.
Mm-hmm.
Or as a fertilizer, which is the other thing you've pointed out is also a misnomer. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, a little bit more at this point about, the, you know, materials to use and materials not to use. You're being very cautious in keeping most kitchen waste out of a compost pile. A lot of, you know, websites will put that high on list of things that one should put into one's compost pile. But are there, could you go over a couple of the real no-nos in composting?
Yeah, the real no-nos.
Yeah.
I would say
a
in
cat's
a backyard.
Litter.
A cat's litter.
Yeah, yes,
that's,
or no?
That's definitely a no-no. Thank
why?
You for bringing that up.
Anytime.
Why?
No, seriously, why?
No, I'm getting to it. The reason being is, you know, when you start... this is easy actually. So a lot of manures, you know, you're going to say, well, how is cat manure that different than, you know, chicken manure, horse manure,
sheep
whatever
manure,
sort of manure,
goat manure, all these
yeah.
things apparently are okay except my pets.
yeah, and it's predominantly you find, I think the commonality that's found here is the omnivorous or meat eating creatures, so things like cats, their manures tend to be a little bit more pathogen-rich, and that's when you start getting cautious about, are your hot temperatures actually going to be killing off all the E. coli or the salmonella or whatever is incorporated in their manure? You know, guys like horses, their manure is pretty benign. Chickens, you know, they're omnivorous creatures as well, but they, you know, they tip the scale towards the plant base a little bit, so their manure is a bit safer. That's the quick... that's the quick answer.
Yeah,
I would
meat
say.
Eater manures are probably may have more pathogens.
Yeah, and you can't necessarily count on your backyard pile to do that. And even like, you know, the big scale commercial composters, the guys who process stuff and then sell it to you at the garden store, they're not taking in pet waste either. It's kind of an area they don't want to touch. It's just the the technology or the processes or practices aren't really there yet to guarantee that all that stuff gets killed off.
Yeah, and it's something you don't want to take chances.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Good question. Thanks for bringing that up.
No cat litter. All right.
Yeah.
Any other big no-nos?
I would say, you know, just along the lines of no litter from meat-eating animals, I'd say meats in the backyard pile. You know, if you've kind of made up your mind and you decided you want to go with the, you want to be putting in kitchen scraps in your backyard bin, definitely I wouldn't encourage you to put in any meat or any dairy products or anything like that. Keeping it on a fairly plant-based or vegan diet of kitchen scrap inputs, that's going to do a lot. And it's the same issue, you know, pathogens, not sure if it's going to get hot enough. And, you know, that raw hunk of meat is going to be that much more attractive to the raccoons or rats or whatever you're trying to discourage coming around your pile.
You said vegan, and I've also seen the statement that things like cheeses, milks, and so on, things that are high in fats are mm-hmm. simply harder for the microbes to break down. So they're going to sit there attracting pests for a while.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so if I'm going to do kitchen waste, stick to the vegetables and the fruits.
Yeah, vegetables, fruits, breads. You know, you get if something's cooked with a little butter on it, it's not going to be the end of the world. If that makes it into your backyard composting system, but really plant-based foods is really or plant-based food scraps is that's the best kind of food waste to be putting in your backyard pile.
Okay, well, I'm going to bring up one of my pet peeves, which is mm-hmm. when I run into people who say, well, you know, I don't put avocado pits or orange peels in my pile because they don't compost. And my feeling is, oh, yeah, they do. I mean, first of all, I've picked up an avocado pit and crumbled it in my hand, and they're the most marvelous rich red color when they get soft enough. But, of course, we're talking about different things here, they and I.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's got their kind of classic, you know, just like I said, everyone has their favorite things to compost. They have their, everyone's got their least favorite things to compost as well. And the orange peels, the avocado pits, even the avocado skins, actually, people complain about. If you're thinking about yard waste, straw is my least favorite thing. And, you know, at that point, it really becomes, it's kind of the minutia of your pile that's dictating if that stuff's going to break down or not. And I don't know if there's anything you can really get any sort of fine-tuned levels of control of if your pile is going to be able to break down an avocado pit at this time or not. You know, sometimes you might get your mix right and it'll break right down, and you know, sometimes it might just be a little off and you're going to have a fairly hard avocado pit at the end. That's not to say you can't put that avocado pit through the process again and have it break down that much more, but absolutely, that stuff is organic material and can be composted and break down over time.
Well, it's
those are also
sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, those are also items that, you know, large-scale professional composters have trouble composting, and they'll often throw them through their processes two or three times.
Mm-hmm. So, well, that's what I do. And essentially, mm-hmm. when they say they don't compost, what folks tend really mean is in one round.
Yeah.
And so if you want to put things in and have a perfect, you know, compost that does not need any sifting and in which there are no recognizable items, then it's true. You're not going to want to put an avocado pit in there. But if you're either sifting or you're just, you know, going through it with your fingers and you pick out a few things and toss them back in the bin and that's okay, then they're fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a matter of style.
Yeah, I think. And that's, you know, that comes into play in composting a lot.
Style.
I would say. Yeah, matter of style.
I love
you know,
that.
You can spend a lot of time managing for this stuff and, you know, really working to get a pile that the finished material doesn't have to be sifted or anything. Or you can take kind of a more hands-off process and know that, you know, nature's going to do its thing and break down organic matter over time, and you're going to get some good compost at some point down the road if you want to wait for it. So, you know, two different ways of style, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Well, mm-hmm. Can we spend our last few minutes going back to the question, well, two questions. One is benefits that we left hanging, but here's another one.
Sure.
You said, and you know, that organic materials in a landfill, as they break down, will produce methane. Why aren't they producing methane when I compost them in my backyard?
Sure. It's not to say that they can't produce methane. They're producing methane in a landfill because that stuff, when the organic materials go in there, it gets compacted, gets pushed into really tight corners. I mean, spaces of landfills are finite, and so that's cutting off those channels for oxygen to access that material. And so then all that organic material starts breaking down anaerobically, so without oxygen, and the byproduct of that is not just ammonia gas, but methane as well.
Why isn't methane produced if my backyard compost pile goes anaerobic, or is it?
Oh, it is. It's just in, it is happening there, and it's not to say that methane is this, you know, terrible, awful gas. It's a natural byproduct of natural processes. That's anaerobic decomposition is a natural product. It's really just a question of scale at that point. You know, think about how large landfills are and how much food waste can go into them and how much, methane gas can be generated over time. You're not going to get nearly that level of methane production off your backyard pile. So if a little bit is generated, if your pile goes anaerobic for a day or so, don't worry, break it out, take your pitchfork, start fluffing it up, work in some of that air, turn it to get that oxygen in.
And it'll be fine.
Yeah, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
The methane police aren't going to come after you.
That's exactly right. The eco police are okay. And methane is odorless. So even if it, you know, the stink, as you said, is not that of methane, it's the ammonia.
Yeah. And they're very, and I can't actually remember the chemical formulas for for ammonia off the top of my head, but they're very close compounds. They're very similar, and they kind of go hand in hand in a lot of ways.
Okay. Now, these benefits. We mentioned already that compost feeds the microbes in the soil and that the microbes help to mineralize, in particular, nitrogen and make it available to plants. But what are some of the other benefits of compost for the plants and the soil as opposed to the environment and my pocketbook?
Sure. So for plants and soil, drainage and water retention are huge things. Being able to work compost into a sandy soil, it's going to help that stuff. I mean, it really acts as a giant sponge in a lot of ways. It's instead of having that water run through your sandy soil, it's going to hold onto it, and that organic matter and or humus-like material is going to soak it all up and then slowly release to plants over time. So it's going to reduce the amount you'll have to water.
Well, that sounds terrific in sandy soil, but it sounds as though it would be terrible then to put compost into a clay soil.
And this is where that silver bullet part that I mentioned earlier comes back in.
Yes.
There's actually, they're called humic acids, related to that word humus. Mm-hmm. That is, that's sort of embedded in all that organic material. And those compounds actually chemically cause clay particles to disassociate from one another. So clay particles aren't just, so small they pack together. They're actually chemically bound together.
Mm-hmm.
And so those compounds help break those bonds and create little micro spaces for air and water to come in. So you hear that's sort of the classic answer is that compost loosens up clay soil, and what it's doing is breaking up those chemical particle bonds.
Wow, I had not known that. Thank you. I love that.
That's no problem.
Yeah,
it's cool. Isn't it cool?
Yeah, it's very cool. And this is the thing that when I started reading about compost, you see all these claims, and you finally go, nothing can do all this. Come on. Be serious.
Well, it's what nature's been doing to manage its soils and manage for fertility for ages. So we're just accelerating or managing the process as humans.
But the fact that it helps sandy soils hold on to water, but improves drainage in clay soils.
Mm-hmm.
And the other parallel claim that I love is the one about its buffering pH. So that if you have a very alkaline soil, adding a whole lot of compost will help to either literally lower the pH or, I can't think of another good way to say this aside from buffer again. At any rate, it's good in both low pH and high pH soils and makes those extremes less extreme.
Yes. Yeah, that's true as well.
Yeah. And can you explain that at all?
Yeah, I can. And truthfully, I'd say I lean a little bit more to one side that compost is, it's not to say it's bad at both those, but it tends to, or it's better at going from that process you just described from a high pH soil down to a lower pH soil. And that goes hand in hand with those humic acids and other acids that are inherent, that go hand in hand with organic matter as it's breaking down. That's what's that's what's helping pull it to the lower end of the pH scale.
The acids that are in the compost and part of the composting process.
Yeah, that are that are just inherent with the organic matter. It's as that stuff breaks down, it's releasing those acids and help bringing that pH back down. And as far as bringing it up, that is, I have to excuse myself. I'm a little bit at least rusty on thinking, or at least describing the process on a scientific level. But that's not to say that
there, it doesn't happen.
That doesn't work either. Yeah,
it's okay.
But on a slightly reduced level of intensity, I guess I would say.
Okay.
Because the flip side of that is adding, as you add organic matter over time and continuously with, you know, similar application rates over years, you're generally going to want to add lime every, you know, 3 or 4 years or so, every couple odd years, and that would be to bring the pH back up. Because, like I said, it's a little better at tipping your soil to the acid side, but it's not... Not to say it won't help with that buffering as well.
But it does really help with the alkaline soils. Okay. No,
yeah.
That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
No, well, actually, I'm pleased because I have the alkaline soil.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm calling from the Northwest. We've got acidic soils here, so that's...
Well, you have a lot more rain.
Yeah, more rain and a lot more woody material that's broken down over time.
Mm-hmm.
We're in old, lowland temperate rainforests.
Yeah, very different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that we have covered the topic as thoroughly as the time allows. And
yeah, there's always plenty to learn about compost, but it's a simple enough process as well.
Yeah. It's the microbes doing their munching bit.
Yeah, feed the microbes and they'll do the work for you.
Yep. I love that. And it's absolutely the best thing that that you can do for your soil, the simplest, the one good thing.
So
the first and last thing to do, add compost. Although, again, a lot of gardeners don't realize that it is possible to add too much. And so I did think it would be a good idea to spend one moment on that. I know that it can be a problem in landscaping. You don't want to fill a hole that you're planting a tree in with compost because it's going to break down and the land will subside under your tree.
Yeah, that's totally true. And it's a good point. It's it's not a substitute for soil. It's an amendment to soil. And soil has all sorts of compounds in it that compost isn't going to provide. And it needs, your plants need both. And then there's the structural question as well, which you brought up. So generally, if you're sort of putting a blend together, maybe 30% compost. If you're sort of putting together a potting mix or you're going to pot something up and you want to add compost at that point, 30% by volume is about, that's the high limit you want to go with.
And that's going to be in a pot. You're talking about a restricted environment. So you want it very rich.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if you're looking at, if you're planting a tree or something like that, then just a really ballparking, an inch to 3 inches is a good, good quick ground check amount. There's, probably plenty of analysis that can be done for a certain kind of tree and a certain kind of soil and this sort of thing. But generally, if you're, if you're just out there and you want to get the compost in and go move on to something really quickly, just an inch or two is fine. You don't need 6 inches or anything of that sort.
Yeah, that would be overdoing it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Graham. I really appreciate this. And
yeah, you're welcome, Kate. Thanks.
Okay, then. And we will all see how we can improve our compost piles.
Yeah, well, have fun with it. That's what I always say.
Yeah, that's important.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yep, bye.
Bye.
That was Graham Golboff of Seattle Tilt, a nonprofit organization that's been promoting and teaching organic gardening in Seattle for 35 years. You can find them on the web at seattletilth.org. Amongst other things, Graham runs the composting and master composting programs there, and you'll find those on their main page when you click under either Learn or About Us. You can also, and you'll find under that on that page, and on that page, you can find their podcasts about composting. There's much more information if you go to the site map and scroll way down to resources, one of which is compost. That's our show for this week. Be well and garden on.
Pulling weeds, picking stones. Man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, 'cause the time is close at hand. And grain for grain, the sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain, and tune my body and my brain to the music from the land.